In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
Yeah.
The sparkling drinks.
We're talking movies. It's Pass the Popcorn here on a Monday afternoon. Alan Adams joining us in studio. Welcome.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. We were chatting about your weekend. You got to celebrate your brother-in-law's, was it 50th?
Yep, turned 50.
Oh, my
yep.
Lord.
No, it was, for his 50th birthday, he got the perfect 12-year-old's birthday.
That's fantastic.
We went bowling. We played laser tag. We ordered pizza. And his cake, it was his favorite kind of cake, but it had the closest they could get to happy birthday in some Star Wars language. He told me which one it was, and I couldn't remember. But it was like they had like done all the weird like quasi Cyrillic characters and all that stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, it's like okay. It's just like he is who he is.
Well, yeah, and for anybody who doesn't know, he is one of the guys behind Palette Swap Ninja.
That's right, also they're the offshoot of that project, the Kyberpunks. Feel free to look them up on they're available on all the music streamers. And if you've never heard Rick Astley in Huttese, well, now's your chance. But no, it was super fun. We went down to Southern Maine. We all stayed together. My mother and father-in-law, Sheridan and I, Sheridan's brother and sister, their spouses, their kids. It was very, very much a family affair, and it was a great time. It was really nice.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then do we want to talk about yesterday?
Like I'll shout this out. On Sunday afternoon, we had to get back fairly early, after staying down in Southern Maine on Saturday night, because we had an appointment for a sitting for a family portrait with myself, Sheridan, and Stella and the cats. So we did a whole family thing over there at Green Acres.
Which I think is great, by the way.
We're very excited about it. I want to make sure I get it. It's Deb Bell. I believe it's Bell's Furry Friends Photography.
Mm-hmm.
We actually did a session with her last year that we had won at the silent auction at the Bangor Symphony Soiree.
Mm-hmm.
She was great. And, she put out word that she was doing, like holiday sessions with a portion of the proceeds going to, the pet food bank at Eastern Area Agency on Aging, which is one of those small things that I don't think people necessarily always think about. It's getting to be that time when our elderly friends and neighbors are going to be even a little bit more isolated than they already are. And for some of them, like their pets are their closest companions.
Yeah.
And times being what they are, like it's, you know, it ain't cheap.
No.
And so being able to sort of contribute in a small way while still, getting to get dressed up in my Sunday best and try to keep my cat from escaping.
Yeah. So who was more of a challenge to get to pose, Stella or the cats?
Well, I mean, like Stella is so treat motivated. Like once she figured out what the deal was,
yeah.
It was like, oh, all I have to do is sit here and look pretty and I get stuff. All right. I can do that. The cats were a little more apprehensive. The truth is like we brought them in their carrier. To this point, they had never been in that carrier where the destination wasn't something terrible,
right.
Like to the vet or whatever.
Yeah.
Like it's like, oh yeah, strangers are going to come in and jab me with needles. Like I don't want that. So it was kind of nice to actually have a thing where it's just like, oh, we'll just set it down, we'll open it. There was a nice enclosed space so they could wander around. And they were actually both pretty good. We weren't sure how they were going to do for an extended period, like being held and stuff like that. But they handled themselves very nicely. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing the final product.
Well, me too.
Yeah, no. Oh, well, if nothing else, you'll see it when you get our Christmas card.
Looking forward to it because I think we're on our whatever it is about our 18th straight year of like we forgot to do a Christmas card this year.
Yeah, we're hoping that we get out in front of it this time. But yeah. I mean, let's be real. Who knows?
Well, we're going to talk movies this afternoon. We're going to do it a little bit differently this week with Halloween coming up on Thursday. We thought we would look at some great movies for this time of year.
Yeah, well, I've thought about it, and you know, we don't tend to be general when we have these conversations, and I thought it might be fun, particularly with you know that sort of time. I'm sure people are cozying up with their scary movies, spooky movies, what have you. And so I figured, we could just chat a little bit about some of our favorites. I feel like, you know, we've got a pretty wide span as far as taste and stuff like that. So I think it could be a fun conversation.
Absolutely, yeah. And I love a good scare.
Yeah,
and I'm all over the map with it too. I like, give me some good old black and white, you know, classic monster stuff.
Oh yeah, like the whole Universal, like those movies from the 30s and 40s with Karloff and Lon Chaney and all those guys. Like, it's just like, you know a movie is successful whether you're talking about Dracula or Frankenstein or the Wolfman. You know it's successful when you basically define the iconography of a character, because everything that has followed in the sort of monster movie genre is, you know, has its foundation in those early monster movies. And I mean, not for nothing, but you know, they clip along. It's like 85 minutes, in and out, and it's like, yeah, let's go.
And Frankenstein is just, that is a well-made movie. Forget horror, regardless of genre, that's just a nearly perfect movie.
That, I mean, and that's the thing, and it's a wonderful reminder of how inspiration could be derived from constraints, because those filmmakers, they had like a week. It's like, you got 10 days, you know, you got these three leftover sets from, you know, three other movies that we've done. Okay, here's a castle. You can go film in the field outside. And here's a road. Have at it.
You're right.
And then
knock yourself out.
You know, and then these incredibly hardworking film, they create masterpieces, and it's just, it's a reminder that you don't need all the bells and whistles to make a great movie.
Absolutely. And along that same line, I do love the old black and white stuff. A classic like Val Lewton's Curse of the Cat People.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just so creepy and atmospheric. And I have a real soft spot, too, because they were always shown on reruns when I was a kid for the 50s. Nuclear mutation horror movies.
Well, that's what, and we've talked about this a little bit, but it's horror, I think, more than any other cinematic genre, has always been really good at reflecting the times in which the films are made. And, you know, when you're dealing with fear, such a sort of fundamental kind of like part of the human condition, like, all you got to do is figure out what people are scared of and find a way to just give that a little tweak. Mm. And then it's like, oh, yeah, now it's like you get like, whether you're talking about giant monster movies like all the Godzilla films, or like the drive-in fare, like It Came from Outer Space, or the original Blob, or like any of those, you know, The Day the Earth Stood Still. That's more sci-fi, but you know, it's one of those things where it's like the idea that you know, these developments in our society are somehow going to be magnified in a way that that places us in some sort of existential danger, and it's fascinating, like. And I mean, again, like, if you watch, like, it's dudes in suits and like pie plates on strings, and you know, and let's stick an extra tail on this thing, and let's figure out how to scale up these rabbits, or you know, or killer plants, or yeah, like, I mean, there's crap out there like Night of the Triffids, which but it's just like, but that's part of the joy of it too, like,
yes.
There's the visceral nature of horror movies, I think, is what draws us to them. And you know, sometimes that viscerality is expressed through being afraid, through that sort of adrenaline jolt, and sometimes it's expressed through a laugh, because it's like, you know, it's like the feelings are still there, but we express them in different ways depending on how the energy is being conveyed to us.
And I don't know if it's quite a golden age, but we've seen a pretty good run of some really terrific horror movies in the last 5 or 6 years, Jordan Peele certainly being number one on the list.
Yeah, you got, I mean, that conversation starts with Jordan Peele. But between basically between him and the work that the folks at like A24 are doing, you know, this idea of I wouldn't even call it like the term is elevated horror, which I have mixed feelings about. I don't think that's what you would necessarily call what Peele does, because he is very much working within the genre, just using it to express his own ideas and his own, you know, he's basically got his own mirror that he's going to hold up to society, right, and be like, hey, take a look, folks. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that scary? Whereas on A24, you get, I mean, I think the, like stuff like The Babadook and It Follows, like those sorts of movies. But then you get like that into that sort of folk horror realm with something like Midsommar.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It still creeped me out.
But yeah, it's just the flexibility of the genre, I think, is one of the reasons that we keep finding our way back to it. And it's also because it existed in, I'm not entirely sure what I want to say here, but like it was deemed as less than, I think, in terms of like quote unquote art, like artistic expression. And so you had a lot of like a lot of room to play, you know, like you weren't necessarily bound by the conventions of what the people of the time consider a good movie, which is why someone like Roger Corman was so successful. But, you know, you talk about the schlock that Roger Corman put out, he also essentially trained every filmmaker you love,
right
like certainly in a certain generation. Like he gave them these like bare bones scripts, said you've got 12 days, you've got x number of dollars, I don't care what you do, just deliver me three reels, something that can play at the drive-in. And you could, and these, you know, that's where like someone like Ron Howard, like,
right, Peter, you know, Bogdanovich,
exactly, you know, all these guys who wouldn't necessarily have gotten a shot or would have taken much longer to get their shot through the traditional studio system. Corman was just like, I just need content, so let's go. But yeah, so it's that flexibility allows for us to talk about all sorts of different issues through that lens, and you know, and get some, you know, get a few jump scares or whatever out of it along the way.
What were the movies that scared you when you were a kid?
Oh God, when I was a kid, you know, and it's like some of them aren't even horror movies, but I will say, just as an example, I definitely saw The Shining too young. so that did some fundamental rewiring.
Oh, sure.
Of my brain. A movie that I was very frightened of when I first saw it, I was probably 5 or 6. Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh yeah.
Scared the heck out of me.
Oh, sure. I still think Poltergeist is an incredibly scary movie.
Oh, well, I mean, there's a run there in the early 80s where it's just like, just absolute banger after banger coming out. Like you mentioned Poltergeist, you know, The Thing, like which I would argue John Carpenter's made a lot of incredible movies, a lot of incredible horror movies. I'm not sure you top The Thing just in terms of, I don't know, we were talking about that viscerality, and it's a very damp movie, like everything, yes, sort of glistens, yeah, just, yeah, a little bit, yeah, and it's just like, oh, this is all very gross and unsettling, and it's one of the joys of practical effects, because you don't get that vibe from the sort of CGI stuff, which is why you always, I'm always going to be a fan, particularly in this genre, of going practical whenever you can, right, because
I'm not a big fan of the slasher movies, but I did like Texas Chainsaw Massacre a lot, and I was reading something about it recently, and they were talking about how what scares you in that movie are the things you don't see, and that you actually think you saw things that you didn't really see.
Right. Well, that's one of the great things about Tobe Hooper's he's a great filmmaker, and that's an absolutely masterful piece of horror filmmaking, because it does, and it's weird to say about a movie called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it's very much a masterclass in less is more.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, you know, and it's something that some of the subsequent versions of that film have forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about Leatherface chainsawing people. That's not what the movie's about. That is part of it. But it's like, it's all about like allowing us to be frightened by, I don't know, the closed doors, the people we don't know behind closed doors. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so, that fear of the unknown, it's sort of being made manifest, by, you know, a giant dude wearing a skin mask, but still, but yeah, like, you know, I have a soft spot for some of the early slashers, like, you know, like, I mean, we mentioned Carpenter. Halloween is a great movie. I think the first Friday the 13th was a good one.
Yep.
Ditto Nightmare on Elm Street. But they fell victim, like so many films did in that particular time, to the diminishing returns of sequelitis. Like they tried to do too many, the budgets kept dropping, and the profits kept going down, but you know, you drop the budget, you're still making a profit. Mm. And so those movies were cheap to make, and so they just sort of kept churning them out. You know, and they kind of turned into a bit of a joke. And so it's been nice to see efforts to, you know, in recent years to sort of reclaim that side of the thing. But I'm kind of with you, like the lone guy with a machete slash axe slash whatever doesn't really do it for me in the same way.
Well, and I like, you know, the ones that get you in the brain.
Yeah, the thinkers, for sure.
I thought, was it The Others with Nicole Kidman?
Yep.
Several years ago? I thought that was a terrific, and Casey Affleck, Ghost.
Oh, yeah, or like,
Ghost?
Yeah,
what's it called?
I live with a ghost or something, something like that.
Yeah, it was great. And it was such an original take on that idea.
Well, and that's, I mean, that kind of gets into the realm of like, you know, horror comedy or like meta horror, like once you start, but again, it's a genre that lends itself to being able to play with those sorts of ideas and tropes. And so that's when you get like Sam Raimi, you know, coming out of the gate with the Evil Dead trilogy.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, Evil Dead is very much a low budget, you know, like eldritch horror kind of thing. And then, you know, they watched the movie, they watched it with people and were like, oh man, this movie's way funnier than we thought it was. What if we leaned into that?
Right.
And then for the ostensible Evil Dead 2, they basically just made the same movie again and just said to Bruce Campbell, all right, Brucey baby, cook. And he did. And then, of course, Army of Darkness, like they scaled up considerably, also very funny. But, you know, those movies kind of allowed the cartoonishness of the genre to shine through, and so you get something like like Shaun of the Dead, just an incredible movie.
Zombieland.
Yeah, you know, like and again, we could spend a whole bunch of time on like on zombie pictures and like what George Romero did to basically define an entire sort of like subgenre of horror forever. Like that's like we're not going to change how we feel about zombies. And George Romero sort of defined that for us, largely, I think, due to some unfortunately questionable business decisions on his part. Because you know, Night of the Living Dead, he let the copyright lapse, and so every like, you know, late night, you know, local network, at, you know, if they had space at 2 o'clock in the morning, they could just put it on and for no charge. And so, like generations of people saw that movie. And so that sort of idea is ingrained in our brain. And it's funny, you talk about ideas, like these sort of archetypal kind of subconscious. I don't think any movie has captured that, as well as, the Cabin in the Woods.
Oh man, that was great.
Which was a phenomenal movie that really just like leaned into like not only took advantage of these tropes, but just like, I mean, just like brought it all together and blew it all up and was just like, hey, what do you think about this? And like, I love it. I love it when stuff like that happens. But then, you know, you have like the sort of, you know, that sort of self-aware kind of horror, which I think, you know, it's not as overt, but like, I mean, I think like, you know, I think Jordan Peele is a particularly gifted producer of that sort of thing. You know, that awareness of tropes allows you to subvert them. And once they're subverted, like, the sky's the limit. You can go any direction you want.
And I thought John Krasinski had such a great and original idea with Quiet Place.
Yeah. Like, and it's really interesting because I wasn't sure. I really liked the first one. And yeah. I'm like, are we really going to do a sequel to this? I thought they handled it very nicely. But then if the idea of bringing it back to the prequel, I get it. I'm someone who kind of enjoys a little bit of mystery. Like, mm-hmm. I don't need to necessarily have my hand held through like the origins of whatever terrible thing is happening. Like, just as an example, like, yeah, I don't need to know how your zombie apocalypse started.
Well, tell me your origin story, zombie.
You know, but it's like, you do something like, I mean, I think 28 Days Later is a great example of this, where it's like, it's basically in media res. Like, it's like Cillian Murphy wakes up and it's like, where the hell is everybody?
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh yeah, no, it's zombies. Although, and I'm not gonna spend too much time on this, but real zombies don't run. 28 Days Later, you can call them what they're horrifying creatures. They're not zombies because zombies don't run. Zombies shamble, they moan, they ask for your brains, and that's that. George Romero taught us what zombies are. I'm just saying. But yeah, like, I don't know. And it's like, and you can just go on and on. And then it's like, and then you have like the sort of, when they start getting, horror movies start getting a little more complicated, when you start like something like The Exorcist, when you introduce the sort of religious underpinnings, like Rosemary's Baby is another example of that. Like, but again, they're very reflective of their time. Like, that was a thing where it's like this idea of capital E evil, I think, was something that that the culture was very conscious of. I think, you know, in response to the counterculture explosion of the 60s, this idea of moving away from traditional norms was bad. And why was that happening? Maybe something sinister. but yeah, I don't know. It's just there's just so many.
Well, let me ask you this too, because the day's a few days away, and of course the boss here has written a few scary tomes through the years. For your money, what's the best adaptation of a Stephen King horror related novel?
Okay, yeah, like, I mean, see, and that's the thing, and I, you know, it's you feel for the guy, because like he's gotten the short end of the stick on a couple of these adaptations over the years, you know. I mean, stands to reason with all sorts of you know, as prolific as he is, you know, and as many of these projects. It's a good question. I'm a big fan, and it's funny because it tends to be the stuff that's a little bit more grounded that I think works.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if you're gonna like, I don't know if it falls into the quote unquote like traditional horror, but I mean, I think Misery is probably the best adaptation of his work that's ever been done.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I mean, it's certainly horrifying in its way, but like something like Cujo, which is like, just because that feels based in something, those two feel based in something very real.
I always liked them, and again, it's on the border there, but the Dead Zone.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's the same sort of thing. Like, they're, because he's so good at creating that sense of like of creeping dread, and that that sense that there's something we're not seeing, there's something we don't understand. It's easy to like, you could make an argument that pretty much everything is horror. I'm sure he would, you know, he certainly wouldn't shy away from that. But I will say, and I mean, obviously The Shining is.
And the newer version of It, I thought was terrific.
I mean, I like both parts very much. There are some people who were a little down on part two. I don't get it. Like, I thought it was an absolutely brilliant move to sort of divide the film the way they did it. Like, I thought it was wonderfully handled. I think it was the only way you could make it work on the big screen. And I mean, it's like, well, Mike Flanagan is really showing himself to be kind of like he gets it in a way that I don't know that Mr. King has had, like, a consistent collaborator like that who clearly understands. I look at something like Gerald's Game, which, and we talked about this, but like, I would have told you that that book is absolutely unfilmable.
Right.
Like,
right.
Just like, there's no way you can make that that book into a movie. And not only did Flanagan make it into a movie, he made it into a great movie. Mm. You know, and so, and like, and his work on Dr. Sleep, the Shining sequel, was excellent, you know, and
it's
just
like,
and, you know, and it's just, so I don't know. I mean, I guess ultimately my answer is probably The Shining, but I mean, it feels like a cop-out because, like, that's, I mean, that's a lot of people's answer, I would guess. I do think it's funny that it's probably the one that,
that
he likes the least.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I ride hard for Stephen King. I ride hard for Stanley Kubrick. So, I mean, obviously it's gonna fit for me. You know, and there are some where it's just like, you're like, oh, well, I saw it. That's fine.
Yep.
We're good. But, you know, but the thing is, when you have someone who's that talented and who is generating that much stuff, like, we're not even close to seeing the end. Like, no. We're going to be seeing cinematic versions of Stephen King's work for generations to come.
Right.
Like, as long as there are movies, people are going to be making movies out of his stuff. Because, again, it's like we were talking about. Like, he has an understanding of sort of the sort of primal nature, the viscerality of fear, and has a real knack for bringing that to life. And there's always going to be a market for that.
Absolutely. Good stuff there. Halloween night, stop by Alan's house, full-size candy bars. You inspired us. Graham said we have to do that, so we got them at our house too.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Yep. No, there are a couple. We're going to save a couple back because there are a couple special guests coming from outside the neighborhood visit. But yeah, we're looking forward to it. I love it, man. I love making a kid's day.
There you go. Well, have fun this week.
Hey, you as well.
Thanks, Alan. Alan Adams talking movies with us here on Pass the Popcorn. It is 5:49. We'll take a break and wrap it up after this. Feel more confident and in control of your financial life. Ameriprise Advisors can work with you to provide personalized, goal-based advice based on your short